This week on Making Contact.
People do identify themselves with the land. You take away their land, you're killing them.
We saw the nests of the birds, even we saw the eggs almost having cracks, and when the young tens were looking on the lice for the first time, it's incredible, they seem so defenseless. And that's why I was thinking that lawyers need to help them to do these things.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile four brave young ecologists going to court for environmental justice and rescuing natural resources and native cultures. Anne Kajir is an indigenous lawyer fighting for the rainforest and the people of Papua New Guinea. Olia Melin is a Ukrainian lawyer who stopped her government's destruction of the Danube Delta wetlands. Dana Rassas is a Palestinian activist exploring transboundary water policy issues in the Middle East. And Ilana Milam is an Israeli advocate for the indigenous Bedouin people. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. Not so long ago, tropical rainforests covered 12% of the earth, providing half the world's oxygen. Industrial logging has reduced them to only 2%. Life on Earth depends on the survival of healthy rainforests, yet rampant logging continues all over the world, despite the shrinking supply. No one needs to tell that to indigenous lawyer Anne Kajir, who grew up in Papua New Guinea in the largest tropical rainforest outside the Amazon.
Oh, that's the best place that you could ever go to. It's home. You can go and do whatever you like. You can go swim. You can go and catch fish. You can cook if you want to cook. You can do anything you like. It's special. It gives me a sense of serenity. You're at peace in this wilderness. Yeah, it's amazing. I am an indigenous person. My childhood was spent in a town where my father and mother were working, and my weekends were spent back in the village, swimming out at sea, going fishing, going gardening, doing what the village people do, living in a bush hut. As a child growing up, it's passed on to you, you know, naturally. Your parents keep telling you that, you know, this is where our boundary is. Don't cross the boundary because that's somebody else's land. You know where your waterfalls are, where your rivers are, which areas to go fishing. It's a traditional birthright. You need to get your house building materials from the forest. You know what trees are, which trees are, what the purpose of those trees are. So you know that, you know, this tree is supposed to be for roofing. It's too young, so don't cut it down. There are those practices that are in place that we have always had. So conservation is not a new concept to Papua New Guineans. They need to be brought back into that traditional mindset where, you know, we had the love of the environment. You know, we looked after one another. We protected everything. We did everything communally. And we've got to care for each other. That's our culture.
Anne Kajir's parents educated her in the ways of their indigenous culture, but they also sent her to school and she became a lawyer. In one of her first cases, Anne exposed government corruption and complicity in illegal logging of the rainforest. Papua New Guinea's constitution guarantees the land rights of its indigenous people who own most of the rainforest, but Anne found that the government was colluding with logging companies to rob indigenous landowners of their holdings.
The agreement that takes away their rights over their forest resources is called a forest management agreement. So it is an agreement that gives the right of the landowners over the trees to the state for an X period of time. So it's basically a lease agreement. In that process, they don't get told, you know, what is going to happen on their land. The benefits are not properly negotiated. For those who can't read and write, they're forced to either put a fingerprint on the legal agreement or put an X. Somebody holds their hand and basically draws the X for them. They are misled. They are forced. They get intimidated. If they don't want to put their X on it, they have, you know, members of the police task force there. That's intimidation. You know, you're going to, obviously, you're going to get scared and you're going to put your X on that piece of paper because you don't want the guns pointing to you. You don't want, you know, you don't want to know. That's not fair. They give away their rights because they think it's in the name of development. They think they're going to get good roads, good schools, good bridges. And they say, okay, that's okay, come and cut my tree, so long as you can give me that. They're misled into believing that these things will happen. In most of the situations that I've come across, there is no school, there is no road, there is no proper bridge. You know, infrastructure is being built, but not to last a lifetime. It's there now and it's gone tomorrow. When the rain comes, the bridges collapse. The road, you can't even get through the road, it's quite slippery. The river is muddy and murky. It's no longer a clean, fresh, flowing stream. That's not development.
In her efforts to defend Indigenous landowners and protect their forests, Anne has often faced threats and violence.
Oh yeah, lots of times. My boarding pass being torn up. I can't even get on the flight that goes into the area, come out of the area after visiting my clients. You know, threats about being locked up in containers. That's no good. Your laptop being stolen while you're asleep at night and nothing else being taken from your unit, that's a threat. What is it that they want on your computer? It just angers me that there is nothing being done to at least put people behind bars for doing that to people. That's wrong. You know, you expect people like the police to be the upholders of law, justice. They shouldn't be doing that to our citizens.
Anne Kajir sees rampant logging in Papua New Guinea's rainforest as part of a worldwide assault on indigenous cultures.
Globalization, it's not good. It's this drive to make money, 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 money without any consideration for environmental justice, without any consideration for, you know, the fact that you are going to be committing genocide because people do identify themselves with the land. You take away their land, you're killing them. And our government is not worried about that. It's more worried about how much money it's going to make, how soon people are going to get rich. And they end up being the ones who sell our land and our resources. I guess the world has got to wake up and help at least protect what we have, in that if you're cutting down our forests at this rate, if you're extracting the minerals at this rate, you know, you're killing off basically all the clean air, you know, that we can breathe on Earth.
In 2006, Anne Kajir was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize for outstanding eco-activism. She hopes the honor will bring worldwide attention to the plight of Papua New Guinea.
The media's got to now deal with me back home, and they've got to say, well, she was the one who opened her mouth up in the first place about human rights abuses, and here she is winning the Goldman. What are you going to do about that? What is really important is that I think the world recognizes that we have an important role to play. And I'm not insane. I'm a normal thinking person and I think I'm doing what is right. And more people should come out, at least in PNG, to talk about the importance of, you know, having that environment there for us.
In 2006, another young lawyer won the Goldman Environmental Prize for her outstanding advocacy on behalf of the Danube River Delta. Ukrainian Olia Melin went to battle for this vast 1 million-acre wetlands when her country's government announced that it would be dredged to make way for a shipping canal. The Danube Delta wetlands contain the largest reed beds in the world and are a UNESCO World Heritage Site and Biosphere Reserve. Visiting the Danube Delta, Olia Melin fell in love with it.
Danube Delta is the place where there are rivers, ponds, and those places are quite distant from the human settlements, and nobody can get there except sailing a boat. That's why the nature there is not very much altered under the human activities. When we first came there, we were shocked by the beauties of the nature. We were inspired by the abundance of birds, fish, other species. I haven't seen so many birds never in my life. They having nests where they have their small birds breeding, laying eggs. You know, it's incredible. Even we saw the eggs almost having cracks, and when the young tens were looking on the light for the first time, it's incredible. They seem so defenseless. And that's why I was thinking that lawyers need to help them to do these things. I think those people who are trying to dredge the canal there, they haven't been there. Because it's really very inspiring. You must be really very blind not to see this and not to feel sorry about making such an cruel attempt to destroy this. So the government in early 2000 started their plan that they want to dredge the canal in the Danube Delta area. The official purpose of dredging was to create a navigable way that will allow ships not to use Romanian canals, but to use Ukrainian ones, and for the ships to have the access from the Black Sea to the Danube River. And in 2002-2003, it was evident that they will make their plans come true. All of the decisions were taken in a very secret manner, and there was no accountability of the officials for their actions. So what was also shocking, that both the people and the government, they were quite indifferent to environment. So nobody was caring about the environment because people were trying to take care of the economic interests, and usually those economic interests were limited by the economic interests of their own families. And that's it.
Olia Mellon and her organization Environment People Law, or EPL, filed suit against the pre-Orange Revolution government in the Ukraine, but they were too late to halt completion of the first phase of dredging.
What was really, really shocking, that the government of Ukraine was dredging the canal during the spawning period, which these activities are totally banned. Nobody can do any commercial activity during that period, but they were doing dredging during the spawning period when the Danube herring goes down the stream to the Black Sea. So probably this also was quite harmful, but it's a pity we don't have the real result of the monitoring.
Only 22 years old, Olia took the lead for EPL, and in her first courtroom case ever, she faced off with Ukrainian government lawyers who used all kinds of scare tactics against her. They publicly accused her of being a traitor and a Romanian spy, and mocked her for having no experience and being unprofessional. In response, Olia and EPL broadened their lawsuit to include international agencies.
I think we managed to make a lot of troubles to the Ministry of Environment and to the Ukrainian government. That's why they calling us spies, Romanian spies. They were accusing us and me for being not professional, of being the enemy to the economic development of the territory. So partly it was because I'm young, it was because I am woman. Usually men are in this sphere, so you can hardly find the woman doing such kind of job. So they were maybe quite afraid of me. Yeah, I think being young and being woman, it was the advantages. They were not anticipating that I could be a good professionalist and I could do my job on a high professional level. So they got a few surprises in court and afterwards.
Olia Mellon and EPL succeeded in halting the dredging of the Danube Delta Canal, but Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko has publicly voiced his support for its completion. Mellon and EPL are ready to mount a legal challenge to stop the Ukrainian government permanently. Olia will need international support and hopes that the Goldman Prize will strengthen their cause.
I really hope and I really believe that this prize will draw more attention to the environmental issues and to the issue of the canal construction. I hope that this prize will open a few more doors for me, for the public, doors of the high officials. So I hope that this will be a clear indication that the job that we are doing is really the right choice and the international community is supporting this. It really now shows that I made the right choice when I came to my NGO, when I started to be a lawyer. So I really made the right choice, and now I don't regret that I'm now not a business lawyer earning a lot of money, you know. And sometimes people, especially the business lawyers or the governmental lawyers who are our opposite party in court, they're asking, why are you doing this? You're doing this for money or what? Who is paying you? And I'm usually having the answer, because I care. Somebody needs to do this. I really care about what I'm doing. I'm not doing this for money or whatever. when I come to the Danube Delta again and again, I feel, I was doing right choice, and we were quite successful in protecting this place.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information, or for a CD or cassette copy of this program, or if you'd like to support our work, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Dana Rosas and Ilana Milam are both graduate fellows at the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies in the Middle East. Established in Kibbutz Keturah in Israel's southern Arava Valley, the Institute is an oasis of environmental education, research, activism, and international cooperation. Dana, a Palestinian Muslim, and Ilana, an Israeli Jew, have found that work on the environment can also bring coexistence and understanding. Dana Rosas had finished a degree in political science and computer languages in Jordan and was searching for a way to help Jordan steward its scarce water supply when she discovered the Arava Institute.
I came into the Arava Institute with an interest in transboundary water issues and environmental policy. You have a death wish when you study political science in the Middle East, I guess, because you can't do anything without upsetting at least 4 or 5 different authorities. But at that point, I felt that this is what can make a difference. This is what can bring a major change into the region. There were so many different difficulties of not getting access to water, of not having enough water, having really bad quality water, living in Amman, and even during the 90s, just by my parents reminding me not to drink from the tap water. I remember my mom boiling the water. We could afford to buy water, filtered water. A lot of people couldn't. I knew that water, I've read it somewhere, and I know it was said by some official at the World Bank, potentially the next world war would be over water. So I got there for a semester, got the biggest life-altering experience. The whole first semester was a cultural shock after the other. I should probably mention that the Arava is on Kibbutz Keturah, just so the whole idea of me living on a kibbutz. Arab families tend to be extended families, and when we were living in Jerusalem at one point, my grandparents were next to us, my aunts were next to us, my dad's aunts were next to us, and I always joked about, oh gosh, it's like living on a kibbutz, everybody knows everything about everyone. And so it was literally a big shock. I am actually living on a kibbutz. But it was also having my first roommate as a Jewish rabbi's daughter who told me the difference between being Jewish as a cultural thing or being Jewish as a religious thing. And it was amazing. I asked her, do you believe in God? And she said, not really. And I'm like, how? You're Jewish. For us, it has been a concept. Jews. They were never a human side to the story. It became more of a demonic kind of a thing. They are the oppressor. They're this. And it's, for me, it was just this part of the history where I have been on the receiving end and they have been on the really bad giving end. And just through that semester, I was the only Arab Muslim female in that semester. I had to live in an apartment with all Jewish females, and I had to find out what I feel comfortable about, what I don't feel comfortable about. Had to find my own boundaries and how we could interact without intention of hurting each other on a religious level, on a cultural level.
Dana's classes at the Arava Institute also offered her some profound challenges.
You can very well spend the whole year and never talk about what is really important.
And that was one of the things that, at this point, I really appreciate about the Arava, is that they had a peace and environmental leadership seminar, which is a facilitated class where they bring all the students in and put them down to talk about the real issue of culture, of history, of tradition, of identity, of political problems and political boundaries, political barriers. And to say the least, it was a very, very hard experience. Because, you know, you want to keep friends with those people, but you don't want to, like, sell yourself short and not tell your story. But you learn to say it and to accept what they have to say and try to come up with your own version of the story. Because, you know, there is no truth. There's parts of truth. It's a puzzle and we all fit in a piece of it. And that was, I guess, the biggest blessing, is that I still very, very much an Arab, a Muslim, a conservative for that matter. And I still can understand Ilana, I can understand Roy, I can understand Ellie, I can understand where they're coming from. We can probably fill hundreds of books about who's wrong and who's right, but it's not going to do us any good. We're all suffering.
In a class on transboundary water issues, Dana was asked to negotiate water rights in a simulated role-play situation.
When I was negotiating water for the other side at that point, the light lit in my head. That's why they never could work anything out. Because everybody comes in with a set of goals, rules, and what perceived to be true, and they never listen. You never learn without listening.
Dana has moved on to do her master's work focusing on a survey of a new Israeli desalination plant in Ashkelon. She is trying to determine how the technology might be used in Jordan and in Palestine. She's also been asked by faculty at the Arava to help formulate future regional water policy.
I think that could be managed. The problems could be reduced. They could be mitigated, but solved, we're talking about a very, very... Solved means that nobody is upset. And I just cannot imagine a scenario where you'd get everybody happy. That's kind of a utopia and no place. So solved, not, but worked out, managed, compromised, in a sense of a good, everybody agrees. Hopefully, inshallah.
Ilana Milam also learned a basic lesson of the Arava Institute that in the Middle East, ecological know-how must be combined with peacemaking skills.
In the years that I lived in Israel, and in my whole upbringing, being brought up in a Jewish family in London, or being in the army, or going through university, I never had the chance to sit with a Palestinian and just talk. In Israel, most Israelis are scared to enter Arab villages, and you can understand where that fear comes from. So the Arava Institute was the first real chance that I'd had to sit with a Palestinian from East Jerusalem and hear their story. It was unbelievable. It opened up my eyes and my heart. But what the real thing that it really did for me was to humanize that other side, that abstract thing that was, for me, the Palestinians, the people that were always trying to throw the Jews into the sea, suddenly became persons. Musa, Dana, Dawla, it became people with real stories and real suffering. And that was extremely powerful. I always grew up on a story, like everyone experiences that, their story, their narrative. So when I was able to suddenly be in this environment and a healthy space, a safe space to discuss these issues, and suddenly hear that the truth that I was so sure of suddenly isn't exactly that truth, that suddenly there's another side, that was extremely powerful. And I think it was a shock, and it was hard, and it was painful, but it was positive in the fact that it empowered me through new knowledge to then go out and be active.
With a passion for marine biology, Ilana had planned to study bottlenose dolphins in the Mediterranean, but a course at the Institute in Sustainable Development captured her heart.
We actually went and learned about the issues of the Bedouin in the Negev and spent one night in an unrecognized Bedouin village. Really harsh conditions. We got off the bus. The women went to the women's side of the tent to be hosted by the women. The men went somewhere else. And we'd spent these few days learning about these issues that I never knew existed. So coming face to face with these people and sitting with these incredible women and just hearing about their suffering, something inside me just knew straight away that this was something that I had to help do something about. And I also felt very much a responsibility. Being Jewish, being passionate about Israel, believing so much in the state, and then knowing that as us, as a people, for us to have this state, there was a significant, unbelievable amount of suffering for others. And I found myself talking about it so often that I realized if I'm talking about it so much, then it's something I really have to do. And I changed my direction. And I chose to do a research study, a 7-month field study, living in an unrecognized village, living with the community, focusing just on the issue of waste. Because when 76,000 people in the Negev don't have waste disposal services, what the majority are doing is burning. And there isn't any awareness of the dangers of burning plastics and the toxics and the illnesses that are related to them. So what I did was to really do a study to try and understand the situation from many different sides, to really use hardcore academic data to show the state that this is illegal. This is causing not only public health risks for the community, but for all Israeli residents due to contamination of groundwater or due to air pollution. The most exciting project that now we're working on is developing small-scale biodigested technology, which is actually very common in many parts of Asia and Africa, which is a way of actually using organic waste and using toilet waste, because in the unrecognized villages in the Negev, they're open ditch toilets. So they're also health problems and potentially contaminating water. There's a method to use waste and produce methane, which can be then used as heating or cooking or lighting or even refrigerators, and actually solves a lot of the public health problems and the economic problems that are related to having to buy diesel for generators or having to buy gas. Recently, 8 villages out of 46 unrecognized villages have been recognized by the government. And the first village to receive any kind of electricity, actually a solar electricity company donated panels and used the village as a sample, and they've got solar energy. We're hoping that we can use the solar panels and the waste, human and organic animal waste, to be a co-generation of electricity, which would therefore need no connection to grids or non-renewable resources.
In its first 10 years, the Arava Institute has graduated 400 alumni, and 75% of them are presently working for the environment and peace. Dana and Ilana will join those ranks. That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Hamza Aldin, Alexander Fedoriuk, Daniel Hoffman and Davka, and Telek. Special thanks to Stephanie Welch for production assistance. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Peggy Law is our founding director. Senior producer Tina Rubio, Dorian Taylor, communications associate. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.